Events and decisions made in the early months of the American occupation of Iraq are getting far more scrutiny now than they did at the time. The lack of planning for the occupation, the failure to control looting, and decisions to disband the Iraqi army and purge Ba'ath Party members from the government are now seen by many as major contributors to the 4 years of chaos and violence that have followed. Our guest Malcolm McPherson covered the early occupation for Time magazine, and when he returned to the United States, he wrote a satiric novel based on his experiences. He shelved the book for 3 years, until it seemed to him the country was ready to re-examine the period. McPherson is a former Marine who was a foreign correspondent for Newsweek for 12 years and has written 12 other books of fiction and nonfiction. His new novel set in Iraq is called Hocus Pocus. Well, Malcolm McPherson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this novel that you've written, Hocus Pocus, is set in Iraq, and it begins with the absurd circumstance of some Americans and Iraqis that are traveling on a C-130, these huge military transport planes, and they're flying over Iraq and discover that there's this massive cargo on pallets underneath tarps, and we discover that the cargo isn't food, it's not weapons, it's stacks and stacks of American currency, 17 tons of it. Where did this image come from?
It came from actually my own experience, which was when I flew up from Kuwait. I was sitting across from, flying from Kuwait to Baghdad, and I was sitting across from this soldier who was all festooned in Mylar and helmet, and he had a machine gun and whatnot. And I asked him at one point, I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm guarding the cargo." And of course, my ears went right up. And I said, "Well, what's the cargo?" And he said, "It's 17 tons of $20 bills. And it was that instant that I knew I had a book because, frankly, I mean, for the rest of the flight, I was absolutely consumed with the notion of how can I steal this money? I mean, what else would you think about if you were in a C-130 with $75 million? Underneath you on the land, there was absolutely no law that pertained to any civilian, or probably there was a military law, but I wasn't in the military. It really captivated me, and I knew at that instant that there was a book in this.
And to maybe belabor the obvious, why was the United States flying in 17 tons of $20 bills?
I suppose it was to pay off somebody or some group of people. I can't imagine that it was for any other reason. They did need, because of the dinars, the Saddam dinars were pretty worthless at that point. The only currency that held any sway would have been dollars, and I would guess that. But nobody was informing me, believe me.
The center of the American occupation was the Green Zone, this kind of enclave that was isolated by blast-proof walls in which high American officials and operatives and private contractors worked. Tell us what were some of the, say, some of the physical characteristics of the Green Zone that really caught your eye?
Well, there were no blast zones at that point. They put those up later, or they were installing them as I left. But the Green Zone was you had to have some kind of I used my Virginia driver's license to get in and out of the Green Zone. It was that easy.
So it wasn't so secure at the time.
Well, yeah, there was no need to have it that secure because the day I got there actually was the first. We were driving in from the airport, and a Jeep went up in the air on the other side of the road, on that road between the airport and the downtown of the Green Zone. And it was blown up, and it was the first one to get blown up. It was the first roadside bomb, and it was very, very easygoing in a way. I think I was shot at once that I knew, and the other part of it was that there was a sense of adventure. I mean, we would go into town every night. We'd leave, go across the river. We'd leave the Green Zone. We'd go out to a restaurant of the few that were open. There were a couple of good ones. And we'd sit outside and we'd get a bottle of Suntory whiskey and sit around and talk. And it was mostly the guy. I was living at the Republican Palace at that point. I was living upstairs in one of Saddam's bedrooms and with about 10 other guys and 8 trillion mosquitoes, and it was very hot. And then I finally got a slot in one of the containers in back by the swimming pool. which was air-conditioned, and it was quite nice.
And when you say container, but, you're talking about a shipping container that's been converted to a living space, right?
Which is, yeah, which exactly.
Which was a standard quarters in that area, right?
At that point, it was, and they had an air conditioner and a little shower, and it was actually quite nice. It was very cozy.
Clearly, there were images and thoughts that you brought back with you that made their way into the novel. But tell us some about your reporting in Iraq. What were some of the things you focused on and wrote about?
My assignment for Time was to get my nose under the tent at the Republican Palace, which I did.
Now, the Republican Palace, that was being used then for what?
It was being used as the headquarters of the Reconstruction effort. It was where Jay Garner had set up his group and where—
And the audience, Jay Garner is the general who first went over before Bremer to try and head the Reconstruction, right?
That's correct. Right. And it was now being used by Bremer and his people, and it was growing like Topsy. It was their trailers being built in the surrounding grounds and trying to house as many people there as they could so that the entire green zone was then forming up as a place, because while I was there, they bombed rocketed the hotel that most of the people were staying in from the Reconstruction effort, and they knew that they couldn't stay in a high rise, so they decided to do what they could do by getting as many buildings around the Imperial or the Republican Palace as they could.
So you have this sprawling kind of American and foreign community of government people and contractors and military people, and what do you spend your day doing? Do people talk to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was talking to everybody from Bernie Carrick, who was the former police chief of New York City and who was sent over to start their police department, to the head of USAID. And I became very friendly with General Garner, who is a great guy. And I went all over the country with him, from up in Kurdistan, the town of Erbil, down to Basra, and we went to Hilla. And at that point, in fact, I even went down in Hilla. We were talking to a Shiite cleric, and he said that he knew where to find weapons of mass destruction. And I, the next day, went off into the wilderness trying to find these weapons of mass destruction. Of course, didn't. I mean, it was.
Did he tell you, or did he tell the American government officials?
Told General Garner, and he told a State Department guy who was there translating, and one of the generals who was in charge of that area. And I asked them what they were going to do about it, and they didn't indicate too much. So I found that, I mean, in terms of weapons of mass destruction in that case, that there weren't any. And, I mean, that I certainly hadn't found any, but that was no big deal. I went back to the palace that night, and I ran into, the defense intelligence guy, and he looked at me, and he said, I could have told you. He said, they don't exist. He said, just get over it. And I still thought they were there.
So in the 3 weeks that you were there, the officials inside the tent, so to speak, those in the Republican Palace, had at that point already concluded there would be no discoveries of weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And yet Bremer and others remained obsessed with finding them, right?
Well, I think they couldn't admit that there were none at that point, and I think that hope did spring eternal. And I thought that, you know, but what they were hearing from the intelligence people was what I had heard, was just get over it. You're not going to find any.
You know, you said that your assignment was to get your nose under the tent, that is to say, in the Republican Palace where the U.S. occupation officials were established. What struck you in those 3 weeks that you were on the inside? What struck you as odd?
I think if more than anything, it was the lack of consensus, of the idea that we were doing something there that had been thought out prior to the arrival. It was all very ad hoc, on the back of envelopes and scratched up on chalkboards and whatnot. And there were a lot of meetings of people trying to figure out what to do and how to do it. And these are the big picture guys too. I mean, you know, it wasn't just sort of the tactical stuff, the little details. And it was just very confused. It was a lot of what I thought was a great deal of trial and error. Let's see if we can get this thing to work or not, you know.
What about the Iraqi characters in this book? You know, you write a lot about Americans and their you know, some are honest but misguided. Some of them are ambitious. Some of them are clueless. What did you want to tell us about the Iraqis from the characters in this book?
I think I wanted to tell people about what I saw among Iraqis was how they really were very pleased, excited actually, about having the Americans come in and get rid of Saddam, and how quickly that changed. One night I heard that the great football legend in Iraq, a guy named Ammo Baba, had been thrown in jail. And we went over there to the stadium where these guys were being held by the American army. And they didn't have a clue where Ammo Baba was. And we looked around and we finally found him. And he was with an older man who had just had a heart attack, actually, and was in very bad shape. We managed to get Ammo Baba out, and he went to Amman, to Jordan. He left the country. But I found that these guys were just, you know, very excited about, a lot of the people were very excited about what they were seeing happen to their country, and it just really turned bad quickly.
You said you, as a bunch of journalists, got this football star, Ammo Baba, out of jail?
No, it was the defense intelligence guy and myself who went over there. He had all kinds of clearances and badges and whatnot. So the army guy over there said, sure, take him with you if you want, you know.
Well, this is an interesting moment. Why was this soccer star arrested by, I assume, U.S. military?
Yeah, he didn't know. They came in the middle of the night and they, you know, broke down his door. They accused him of some sort of complicity in something. He was with his wife. The other man was with his wife. They were terrified, and they just had the restraints put on them, and they were put in a Humvee, and they were taken off to the soccer stadium, which was kind of ironic. But he never knew. He had no idea why he'd been picked up. They never charged him with anything, of course, and there he was. So he got out, and we got him out, and you know, he left the country.
Well, let me ask this. How did you and this Defense Intelligence Agency official know that he didn't belong there? How do you know that he wasn't complicit in, you know, terrorism or insurgency?
Well, one thing that we supposed was, and it was a supposition, the question's a good one, we knew that Ammo had been on the national team, and a couple of years before he had been playing down in Kuwait, I believe, or maybe it was Saudi Arabia. And he had muffed a goal. It was pretty easy. And when he came back, Uday, who was head of the soccer program for Iraq, Uday being the son of Saddam, made Ammo do laps in the, swim laps in the sewage treatment tank in Baghdad. And we knew that, everybody knew that Ammo Baba was not a supporter of Saddam Hussein. He hated him, and he, you know, just had to keep his head down in order to stay alive.
Well, that there is an Ammo Baba who is a soccer star in your book, and I think you tell the story of him having been forced to swim in a sewer. That's all true.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Malcolm McPherson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Writer Malcolm McPherson. His satiric novel set in Iraq is called Hocus Pocus. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.